Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were talking about the many engineers we come across who really struggle to believe they can influence a third party or a contractor who's doing something for them because of that contract or the business relationship, which appears to be set in stone and unchangeable, and that governs everything. And we're just talking about how those people can actually still do something to influence the behavior of these organizations that are seemingly under this handcuffed contract.
Well, it is. To make a specific case, is I remember working with a supply. It was not quite a startup, but they weren't very high volume. They weren't an HP or GM or Philips or a major brand company with bazillions of parts. At one point, HP was buying and using 1/3 of the capacitors built in the world.
Right.
It was just, phenomenal number of circuit boards they were building. Plus, they put a lot of capacitors on them for whatever reason, or lots of reasons. But they had influence with every supplier. We'd call them up. Hi, I'm from HP. Oh, okay. Let me get you the senior director of this or that or the other thing. It was no problem having meaningful discussions with senior internal technical people because of the weight of the organization. But working with a smaller company, and they said, we make a couple hundred thousand of these things a year, and we call AVX a major capacitor vendor, and it's hard for us to imagine that they want to even spend the time of day with us because we are insignificant in their portfolio of customers. And I said, that's not true. It's very much not true. Mm-hmm. When you look at it just on revenue, it's not a big deal. But consider this: HP hammers them for profit. Every product they sell us is they make very little on it. You guys, they charge you top dollar, and their profit comes from you. Mm-hmm. So if you say something and have a complaint or a use or whatever, they will listen because you and other customers like you is their profit. That it's not HP. HP is squeezing them because they can. So don't discount your ability. And they hesitated to even contact them for help or for an idea or for a discussion because they thought there's no way they want to talk to us. And they were overjoyed when the technical folks on the other end said, yeah, we'll talk to you. Mm-hmm. It's important to us.
And that's, and that's where you're talking about, you have a perceived lack of, not market share, buying power.
Yeah, buying power. And that's not the only thing vendors or suppliers are interested in. Right? It's they're interested in profit, and you represent a bigger profit margin for them than other big buyers, right? So that's one angle on it. I think people hold themselves back thinking, we're just small fry for these people. We can't talk to them. But I think that is a barrier that you can overcome by just picking up the phone and talking to them, realizing that you represent profit. But the other thing you represent is information, which is almost as valuable to suppliers, mm-hmm. is that we're going to give you a forecast and we are actually going to keep it. Whereas if you're a great, big, huge supplier, the forecasting is, well, you just make it, we'll buy them when we want them, take it or leave it kind of thing. Attitude. Mm-hmm. Where if I can get stability, if I can get into a new market and co-develop a new way to use our products, because you represent a new thing, new opportunity, or we can create you have to figure out what's of value to the supplier. And it's not always just buy bazillion of our parts. That's not always the most valuable thing. all kinds of other things can be of use. And that is a lever then to have influence, but it's also a lever to have discussions, because the supplier wants to have those discussions to improve their product portfolios, to improve their performance. If you go in and say, hey, we can help you with design of experiments to optimize your line, it'll benefit us, but it'll also benefit all your other customers. They would be interested in that. You know, if they're interested in improving their product, if you have that expertise to share with them. So I think this concept, though, of I'm too small to influence these folks is self-imposed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the other thing I got a slightly different concept to talk about, but it's not unrelated to what you just said then. And it's that we talk about the business leverage, buying power, that sort of good stuff, and how you can bring value to an organization because you have a unique perspective. And yes, you might represent higher profit margins because you're not a big player. But I was like focusing on the human side of it. If you if you assume that whoever's building your thing is made up of a bunch of typically young engineers who want to who really want to impress and make things really cool and just have a purpose in life, if you're able to help them understand that purpose and represent the end customer and say, hey, what you're doing is really important, here's why. Oh, and by the way, if you worked on this, it would make it even more important, even more valuable to the customer. It adds that very human need to have a purpose for what we do. And when we have a purpose, we are happier. When we're happy, we're more productive. When we're more productive, everyone wins. So, which is not a million miles removed from what you were just saying when you talked about, hey, they would value you as a small fish in a big pond because your perspective matters. But I think it's sometimes simpler than that. Even if you have a contract, if you're willing to engage the engineers at the coalface and establish relationships with them in a way where you give them purpose or you reinforce their purpose and give them guidance to feel more purposeful, you are going to get really useful results.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. And that applies not just with suppliers or vendors, or applies across the various silos with an organization, or even the team that you're working with. Instead of saying, be here on Tuesday at 8 o'clock, and I was just talking to about meeting management the other day. It's with Carl. How do you create a good environment? Well, it starts long before you get to that meeting, for example. There are facilitation skills that we're talking about. But the idea is that sense of worth is the start of then opportunities showing up, in improvements showing up. I don't know. There's so many examples. When I was working at Hewlett-Packard, I sat on a floor that there was a parallel group that was on the same floor. And they often worked with and talked with the same people that we did, but they were at one point it was called like the software initiative or something like that. And they were tended to work on software stuff in general, but also worked on strategies and governance of programs and project management and stuff like that. But their technical strength was in the software world, where the group I was in, we did some strategic stuff and project management support and so on. But our core strength was hardware engineering. And the powers that be that oversaw both our groups basically said, you guys can't talk to each other, you know, in so many uncertain words. And so a good friend of mine that we used to go running on a regular basis, we're out running and chatting about our work, and we realized that we're doing almost exactly the same thing with the same customer base. So we were competitors artificially. And we decided that we had a project that came up that it made sense for us to work together with. So we very quickly decided not to tell anybody that we were doing that, because they would have shut us down.
Yeah.
And until we got something useful done. And then they held us up as stalwart entrepreneurs that created this new breakthrough value to the organization and all that other stuff. And then they encouraged us, almost required us to always do joint projects. I'm like,
right. Okay. Good idea.
But I think if we would have went and asked permission to do this joint project, they would have thought, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
We have different business models. They can't do what we do, you know, and vice versa. We can't show them what we do. Otherwise, our business will go away. And it's like, what?
I think what we're basically talking about is, regardless of the contractual relationship you have with people who are doing stuff for you, you just treat them as part of your team. And an analogy I often like using is the professional sports team, where mm-hmm. every single athlete is a contractor. They've signed a contract. Now, if you're the coach of that team, do you only interact with that player through their manager or the lawyer or whoever owns the fine print of the contract?
Yeah.
The answer is clearly no. But the contract essentially says you are required to turn up, give your best, work hard, train, all that sort of good stuff. But there's so much more to it than that. The coach is the one who says, I know the contract says you're going to turn up and practice, but this is what practice is. Mm-hmm. This is what our team needs out of you. And you could imagine how sporting teams, the coach is required to go through the lawyers to communicate with the athletes. You know, that's not going to be a successful team, successful sports team. Same applies in real life.
Yeah. No, you hear about it, like with union shops, is everything's got to go through the union teams and through arbitration or this that thing, and it's. A lot of that can be avoided by just treating people with respect and listening and being part of the same team. And then, but when that barriers get put up that are artificial, in whether in a union setup or in an adversarial supplier relationship or in a military contract, this is the contract where don't do nothing else. Those barriers then break down that ability to work together, or artificially put barriers there that mm-hmm. do that. And it takes a bit of effort to go create those relationships, create those mechanisms and bonds to make it work. Sometimes you have to cross that line just to get stuff done. And there's a lot of cultural barriers to doing that, especially if your Kerman organization is creating adversarial roles and cross-bidding and threatening to get rid of suppliers if they don't jump whenever they say jump, you know, kind of thing. And suppliers are saying, well, the hell with this, I'm not bidding on the next project. It's mm-hmm. not worth my, it's too aggravating.
And then there's that other scenario where people who work for government say, well, we're signing to a contract. We've signed a contract with a supplier where it's now an exclusive relationship. They don't fear losing that the third party doesn't fear losing that contract. So it's not like they're doing something which can be sold to another market to give you a certain something for a very specific problem. And so these mm-hmm. people tend to have even more to spare than most because they believe that the contract constrains them. And that little bit of leverage or buying power you talked about at the start of this conversation, they don't believe they have that. So what do you think about the tools that these guys can employ to try and influence the contractor to do good things for them?
Well, the unfortunate part is that in a couple of these military supplier contracts I've seen is they say, thou shalt do FMEA with six people on Tuesday from 1 to 4 o'clock and send us the report. I mean, mm-hmm. You're not allowed to think about how you're going to create your product. We're going to tell you, and mm-hmm. we're only going to pay for this. And this was literal. There was some fancy box that went on an AWACS flight equipment, and it was some sensor and analyzer, something they never could tell me about. Lots of really weird custom parts built mm-hmm. into this thing. The contract was, we're going to buy 10, and in your development, you're not allowed to make prototypes.
Right.
when the design said, oh, I need this, this capacitor, and it's a little itty-bitty chip capacitor, and you can buy a roll of 10,000 of them on a reel for about $30 or something like that.
Yep.
But the procurement guys read the contract and they said, no, we're only allowed to buy 10 of those components, not 10,000.
Right.
So to buy 10 components, it costs us $250, but that's what it is. If you have a failed component, it took all the way to the general manager to get approval to buy another component, kind of thing. And it just was absolutely, well, it's in the contract. We have to do an FMEA. All right, great. How do you do that? Well, we send the bill of material to this third party and they do it and they send it to the contracting authority and they check it off and then we get paid. All right. Okay. Now, why do you think they put do an FMEA in the contract? I don't know.
Yep.
They do a lot of that and we just do it, get it through the contract and we ship them a product. Is that product working? No, not really. They're always complaining. That's why you're here. And it was just the culture. It was the contracting process took 10, 15 years to get in place. And then it would be a development project for 5 years. And the, building the products would go on for another 5 to 10 years to meet the deliveries of it. And it was just anything that was outside of what was in the contract was slapped down as not, we can't do that.
So there's nothing they can do to improve the reliability, what they get because of that contract. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, it was frustrating beyond belief how they worked themselves into this contract, and it was just what they thought was that's how business is done. So they made this Heizutz sensor thing, right? And their existing product was like the size of your desk, for example, and it had a bazillion little bits and bobs in it, and when they would get a new component in, this critical component, they didn't have a way to check to see if it worked. And about half of them didn't work on delivery to them. They were so finicky and so fragile. So they would take apart one of their existing production models, which everything they made was production. They had to ship every single one of them. They would take it all apart, put this new component in it, rebuild it all together, retune it, and then say, oh, okay, that new component works. So then they take it all apart again, put back in the original part that was in there, and then say, hey, we got a good part now. And they just did. And then they would spend the next 3 weeks trying to get that modeled, that unit to work again, because it was so finicky. And every time you took it apart and put it back together, all these very high frequency connectors and stuff were so delicate in alignment and spacing and everything else. It took them weeks to even get it to work again.
Right.
And they were wondering why they were having so many problems. I'm like, well, could we make a test bed that you could test these components in that doesn't involve building out your entire, you're taking apart a production unit? And it took going to the general manager and explaining that you have one of these units you're never going to sell, right? You've abused it so many times that it's a hangar queen. You keep taking parts out of it for other things. And why don't we just make that a test bed? Let's open it up, lay it all out so that it functions in a useful way for you. And you're like, well, we can't do that. We have to sell every one that we make. You're never selling this one, and here's how much money you're wasting every day by not having this thing. Oh, okay. You mean we got to actually make something useful? It was so frustrating working with these guys.
So, I mean, you're talking about changing the contractual framework, which is obviously important if you have a contract which doesn't make any sense, and that happens all too often, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But let's just say the contract isn't quite as horrific as that. I'll come back to what I said earlier. I do believe that if you're able to make a connection with that contracting organization at the human level, give them purpose, regardless of what the contract says they can and can't do, they will, within their little their window or band of options in life, they'll choose options which are going to benefit you more often than not. And then, of course, there's no reason for you to have to, if the contract says we need a monthly report for whatever reason, then you can not, it's up to you to spend weeks reviewing that monthly report every month, or you can just say, thank you very much. Let's talk about something real.
Yeah.
The monthly report's there.
Yeah.
So give me some monthly report. And then once we go through that, can we actually walk the production line? And, you know, I want to speak to your guys and girls and tell us, you know, how we're going, how we can help you, or if they need any advice, you know, just that whole, let's make a human connection, make, give them a purpose. So the people in the organizations, I keep telling them, you can make that human connection. And if you don't, then all the time you're spending on insisting the PowerPoints use 12-point fonts or whatever, it's, that's filling the void of that human connection. And that's what you're tacitly informing these people is something, is what you value. And that's what you'll get. I'm always optimistic in those organizations when they earnestly believe they're constrained by a contract. Sure, try and improve the contract, or try and get some of the crazy stuff out of there. But beyond that, they're human beings, and if you can give them a purpose, that's really, really useful. And the obvious comeback I always get is that, oh yes, but we have, you know, we can't have everyone going on the production line because everyone has their own different sets, ideas and values and everything else. We can't have these competing ideas. And the response always is, well, you own the team. Spend a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks getting all your people in the same room with you so they know exactly what the organization's priorities are, understand your vision, understand your why, understand your purpose, teach them, train them, make you do your job as a leader to get these people trained up and ready to talk about things that matter to your organization, and just don't leave it up to them to guess, because you'll inevitably get different ideas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and unfortunately, where I see it in the worst cases is there's not a leader. We're managing to the contract. Yeah, we're managing to the requirements. People then hide behind the bureaucracy rather than go talk to people. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's all too common. I think we solved it.
Cool. All right. The idea ourselves is, in the back.
Yeah. But it's often those little things that helps break the ice and get things going. And then those more useful discussions actually start happening. But somebody's got to extend a hand. Well, not these days, I guess an elbow, and say, "Hey, we're going to do this." So, but anyway, no, it's an interesting problem. I think there's still a lot more into this, but we'll have to come back to it at another time. So with that, I'm going to ask our audience if they've got some ideas or insights on this part of how to create the influence, how to spark those useful discussions versus the contractual requirements to the letter only, or blending those in some way. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR and let us know. Join the conversation. And as you know, that oftentimes your comments and questions and so on become episodes on the show. It's one way to join it. And we certainly love hearing from you. So that, Chris, you got some influence you got to go start doing this afternoon, or?
Yeah, if marriage is a contractual relationship, yes, I need to try and get more influence in
Yeah, good luck with that.
Nah, I'm overstating it.
But have a good one. It's Friday as we're recording this, so hopefully you enjoy the weekend a little bit. I understand you guys are getting some great weather, so hopefully you get out there and enjoy it. Yeah, the snow is coming. It's coming soon. October, you'll be buried in snow. I know it.
So, thanks, Fred. Hope those fires treat you nicely too.
Yeah. Cheers.
Later. Cheers, Fred.
Right. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.